You're listening to your community radio station, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K284AL Halaiva. It's time for In the Garden on the Farm.
Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Robin and Paul, and on today's show, we will appreciate the importance of good drainage. Marvel at the deep green goddess of the kitchen garden, kale, and figure out how to make your cacti happy. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with our fine sponsors.
Aloha.
Aloha, Paul. How are you today?
Really fine. Thank you so much. So glad to be here on this beautiful island of Kauai. What a place to be a gardener, to love plants, and to love the community that grows them together. And we want to thank everybody for tuning in to In the Garden on the Farm. And we've got a great show set up for you today. And we'll jump in, as we do, with our celestial session, looking at the skies above for inspiration and for guidance on what kind of activities might be appropriate for us to undertake in this time of the year. And we will start by focusing in on the beautiful moon, Mahina, and the Hawaiian moon phase. And today's moon phase is brought to you by the 2014 Hanalei Moon and Tide Calendar, which is a Hanalei Watershed Hui publication. Thanks so much, you guys, for putting all that great info together for us. And they're informing us that today's Hawaiian moon is Hilo. This is in the Anahulu, or moon week of Ho'onui, and it is, in fact, the very first moon. And Hilo rose on Kauai this morning at 6:02 a.m. She'll reach her transit or highest point in the sky at 12:46 p.m. while we're doing the show today, and she'll set at 7:31 p.m. this evening. No part of the moon's face is illuminated on this new moon day. New moon was this morning at 8:40 a.m. Interesting to note, too, on this day, the sun rose 8 minutes before the moon and will set 15 minutes before the moon. That's why we don't see the moon today. The mana'o for Hilo, from a planting perspective, it is the very first phase in the moon cycle, and traditionally planting is not recommended on this moon, or was not back in ancient Hawaii, due to the fact that this moon was kapu to the god Ku. However, fishing was said to be excellent on this day of Hilo.
Very cool. Well, today, in the biodynamic look at things, and tomorrow, the moon will be in Taurus, an earth sign, making it a good time to work with our root plants. Friday and Saturday, the moon will be in Gemini, an air sign, making it a good time to work with our flowering plants. And this is also the time of the month that we get to the apogee of the moon, which is its highest point, and we will enter now the planting time as the moon starts to descend. Sunday and Monday, the moon will be in Cancer, making it a great time to work with our leaf plants. So this is a great time to get our heat-tolerant greens in as summer's coming. Things like Asian greens, bok choys, pak choys really stand up to the heat of the summer. Also our heat-tolerant lettuces. And Tuesday next, the moon will be in Leo, a great time to work with our fruit plants as it is a fire sign. And this is the time of year we've all been waiting for. We can get those cucumbers, melons, beans, tomatoes, eggplants, peppers, and potentially any fruiting trees into the soil. And I'm really looking forward to that. The cucumber season coming on is really a treat.
Well, I hope we get in advance of those fruit flies before, so that we can get some of those beautiful fruits on our table and not back into the compost pile as they sometimes head eventually in the season.
It's true. It's true. The fruit fly discussion is one we'll have to go into depth with sometime this summer for sure.
We're going to turn now to some notable news in the agriculture world. And Robin, you had mentioned the heat of the summer coming on fast now, and this news from NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, part of the U.S. government. They did, a couple weeks ago, they did issue an El Nino watch, and it means that drought and increased hurricane threat for Hawaii is possible. This news from Hawaii News Now. NOAA's Climate Prediction Center has issued an El Nino watch, which here in Hawaii could mean a return to drought-like conditions and an increase in hurricane threats. And El Nino is basically, from what I understand, an increase in the surface temperature of the ocean in the East Pacific. And when it rises above half a degree Celsius, then it can change the weather patterns. And what it does to us in Hawaii is it tends to dry us out in the later part of the year. So we could be facing a very dry winter coming up, and it's also correlated with hurricanes. In fact, Hurricane Eva and Hurricane Iniki both occurred in El Nino years. It's still too early to say what's going to happen, and they just really need to watch and see if it's going to develop or not. An El Nino year was predicted for Hawaii back in 2012, and it never really developed. But we're going to be looking at that and hoping for some moderate weather, of course. Maybe one little silver lining on that cloud would be that if it is a dry condition this winter, we might have good weather for producing seed. And in our very wet northern part of Kauai, and with such a wet winter from this last year, where we saw a lot of seed-bearing plants sort of melt in the rain, it might be nice to have some drier conditions for seed production.
Indeed. And, you know, something I've learned over the years here is that, believe it or not, seed saving actually begins in the spring when we choose our varieties and we plant our gardens out with proper distances between plants of the same that may want to cross and all those sorts of things. So having this little heads up could really help us plan for an excellent late year seed saving adventure, which kind of makes me happy.
Indeed,
when I look at it that way.
There's always a silver lining out there for us gardeners. Another notable news to take note of, and also in the seed world, is that there's a new program called the Open Source Seed Initiative, or OSSI, and they're working to keep seeds in the local domain. And this news story thanks to Lynn Howe of the Hawaii Public Seed Initiative. It turns out the global commercial seed market is valued at almost $35 billion, or was a couple of years ago. And, of course, that's providing a powerful incentive for the biotech corporations to own and patent seeds. However, in response to this work that they are doing to monopolize the seed sources, the University of Wisconsin-Madison recently introduced an effort designed to keep newly developed seeds free for all people to grow. Known as the Open Source Seed Initiative, it was established in 2011 by public plant breeders, farmers, NGO staff, and sustainable food system advocates from around the nation. And they've already released 29 varieties of vegetables that cannot be patented and are protected. And if you want to find out more information, you can go to their website, and that's opensourceseedinitiative.org. And kudos to those folks for making sure that plants will remain in the hands of everyone who wants to grow them and develop them into the future.
Yeah, that's wonderful. You know, when people are living pretty far out and subsistence living, they really just don't have the funds to be able to purchase these patented seeds. Some of us maybe do have the funds, but choose not to put our funds in that direction. And so this is just great for everyone.
Indeed.
Good news.
Have you got a news story for us as well?
No, what I have is news from my kitchen garden.
Ooh, I like that.
And I want to talk about kale. It is just everyone's favorite. It's certainly a plant that is in my kitchen garden at all times. And there are lots of different kinds of kale out there. So first, I'll just discuss that I like to grow all the different kinds of kale because I like diversity in my diet, and certain varieties are better for certain preparations. And also I've noticed just on a culture level that the bugs seem to go after one variety and leave the other varieties alone. So if I only have one variety out there, guess what? I'm getting tagged pretty hard. But I just really like to grow the dinosaur kale, otherwise known as Toscano or Lacinato or Cavolo Nero in Italy, where that kale originates. There's also curly kale, which is definitely hands down the most favorite. There's multiple varieties of that as well. Veit's Blue, the Scottish Dwarf, Winter Boar, probably the most widely grown of all. That is an F1 or hybrid kale. Mm-hmm. There's also Rip Boar, Star Boar. I mean, it goes on and on. Certainly, I've landed with Winter Boar based on my conversations with local farmers, and that really that kale just excels here in the curly world. And then there's also a rainbow Lacinato kale, which is a cross between a red curly variety and the Lacinato kale. And that was developed by Frank Morton at Wild Garden Seeds, and that really is a winner.
Even as an ornamental plant, it's gorgeous.
Indeed, indeed. I have a friend out there who's got one that's 13 feet tall right now. Just really unbelievable. I think he's going for the record kale. Hard to pick at that stage, but never mind. It's just beautiful. And then there's, of course, our favorite seed-saving version, the Ethiopian kale, is the kale that will flower and make seeds here in our tropical environment, making it a really great choice as well. And, geez.
What about the Red Russian kale? Do folks grow that as well? Did you mention that?
I did not mention that. Thank you for reminding me. Red Russian kale is sort of a underdog, not as popular with people, but those who love it really love it. And there's also Siberian kale, which a few farmers offer at market, and that one is probably the most like lettuce of all the kales. Extremely soft. And it's interesting when you look into resistances and conditions that are perfect for these different kales, it turns out that a cold tolerance can also manifest as a heat tolerance, because it's basically just a temperature tolerance within the plant. So it would be, sounds a little funny to grow Siberian kale here in the tropics, but it really does do well. Yuichi at our market there in Kilauea on Saturdays always makes it a point to have that on the table, and he's very fond of it, and he's also made me very fond of it.
Nice. Now, when you're planting these out, what kind of spacing do you like to give them?
Yeah, 2 feet apart. Kales in the Brassica family, all members of the Brassica family, are heavy feeders, and the more spacing you give them, it's basically the more root zone they get, and also their leaves won't be touching. But that's how farmers are, if you're wondering how they get those 18-inch kale leaves. It's because they've spaced them properly. If we squish them together, you're going to end up with smaller kale leaves no matter how much you feed them. But it is wise to get some mild fertilizer for green leafy growth, a nitrogen-type fertilizer, once a month if you want to keep your plants in really good leaf production. Mm-hmm. The kale plants are high in vitamin A. They're good for skin and vision, vitamin K, vitamin C, B complex, minerals like calcium, potassium, iron, manganese, phosphorus. They are just a powerhouse of nutrition, and not to mention they're just so delicious prepared in the kitchen. I believe the curly kale makes the finest massaged kale salad, which is just such a favorite among so many people right now. And there are a million ways really to prepare your kale, from fresh to steamed, throwing them in your green drinks. It's such a versatile plant, which is why I like to keep it in my garden all the time.
Sounds so yummy, Robin. Would you be willing to give a quick recipe for your massaged kale favorite?
Yes, absolutely. So I like to squeeze a little lemon or lime juice over the leaves after I've broken them into small pieces. Pinch of salt and a little oil of choice. If you want to go towards the Asian side, you could use sesame oil or toasted sesame. I like olive oil. Coconut oil makes a great kale salad as well. And then you simply massage all those ingredients into the leaves. And what happens is, just like ceviche, the lemon, the acid of the lemon or lime, breaks the cell walls down and essentially cooks the kale without heat. Mm-hmm. So you get all the vitamins retained, but you get a soft, almost cooked texture. Mm-hmm. And I really do. Lately, I've been enjoying throwing some seaweed like hijiki or the skinny stuff, you know, and black sesame seeds and maybe some grated carrot and radish and mixing it in. And that makes a really excellent, highly nutritious. When you throw a little seaweed in there, you get all those extra sea minerals as well.
Sounds tremendous. And for those folks who are looking for a really easy solution to cooking kale, what I came across was just bringing a pot of water to the boil, turn it off, and then throw your ripped up kale in there and just let it steep for 5 minutes. Make sure when there's other things going on in the kitchen or in life, it's so easy to overcook greens, but it seems like steaming, or rather steeping kale as if they were tea leaves, make sure that they don't get overcooked and the nutrition is retained in there and all the beautiful green, deep green color is still inside.
Yeah, it's no doubt that kale is just probably our favorite garden plant, and thanks for growing it.
Indeed. You're listening to In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. Coming up in this hour, we're going to be speaking all about good growing of cacti with a noted expert here in the Hawaiian Islands. But first, we're going to turn to one of the important soil secrets, and that is the mysteries of drainage and the importance of drainage. And why don't you get us started, Robin?
Sure. Particularly for cacti, drainage is incredibly important, as none of them like to sit in standing water of any kind. But really all plants. There's very few plants that appreciate a bog. I can think of a few off the top of my head, such as taro. But generally, you want the soil to move water through it easily. So one of the first things to look at is looking at your site. And if it's a plant that needs a lot of drainage, you might want to choose a slopey type area. That in and of itself builds good drainage, rather than a low-lying area. You also want to look at choosing the material that you will build the soil with, and that could mean things like basalt rock, cinders, our nice Hawaiian black cinders. Sand also helps with drainage, a nice coarse sand, if necessary.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you said, the taro plant is adapted to flooded or poorly drained soils, and yet the ancient Hawaiians were masters at these systems, and not only were they able to flood the land, but they were able to drain it as well so that they could maintain their taro lo'i, so they could fertilize or fallow their fields. And so there's a lot of that knowledge that's being carried forward by the contemporary taro farmers. Here in Hawaii, we're fortunate that we have pretty good drainage on most of our soils, but due to compaction or other issues, there can be standing water and there can be the need to make some adjustments to the land. And there's different ways that it's done from a commercial standpoint. There's a lot of subsurface drainage systems that can be installed. They can be rather complex and difficult to do. I think if it was sort of a first-time outing, it might be a challenge to install a subsurface drainage system. But if you're looking at curing a problematic drainage situation, or perhaps you're a commercial farmer, it pays to get a professional involved who can really give you some good advice on how you can change the hydrology of your particular fields that may be draining poorly. But even before we think about installing pipes, wells, or other sorts of subsurface drainage, we can really just be starting by cultivating the soil. And as we know, our soils can be very compact, and it can really help to get a ripper in there and do a very deep cultivation of the soil. Can help with drainage dramatically. And then once we do that ripping, then tilling of the soil on the top layer incorporates a lot of oxygen and a lot of pore space in between our clay soils, predominantly clay soils here, and can really help with drainage as well.
Great. Those are larger system solutions I can see. When it comes to a small backyard garden situation, if the area has issues, I would say working the soil similarly, maybe not with a big machine, but by hand, perhaps even the double digging,
yes,
the cultivation method we like so much.
Yes.
And incorporating materials like the basalt rock dust or chips, as it is, cinders. And then also just on an individual plant by plant level, I found that mounding the plantings can really help too in a tight spot where you maybe can't work too much in there, but mounding the planting up just a little bit helps it have some drainage space in an otherwise wet area.
Truly, and we do tend to make the mistake of planting our trees or other perennial plants too low when we get really excited about digging that hole, and we can create a situation where the plant is kind of growing in a pool of water because of the harder soil around. So sometimes even when doing perennial plantings, it's a good idea to create a berm. And we've seen the great effect of that over at the food forest in Kalihiwai,
yeah,
and how much the plants that were planted on the berms thrived so quickly because they were able to send their roots into that soft, fluffed up soil so much better than the other areas, which were tilled but were not piled up soil. So those are some solutions that you can do on that larger scale. Now, all those things being said, drainage is not always beneficial, and some of the times that increasing drainage should be avoided would be when, of course, flooded fields are what you want, or it's important to keep the water holding capacity of the soil if you have a low E, or if you're creating a pond or a reservoir, you don't want to perforate that. And then it's also important if there are wetlands. And certainly, mm-hmm, from a global perspective, we've lost so many of the wetlands to agriculture. Even here on the island of Kauai, the Mana Plain was a huge wetland and is continuously pumped by the military installation out there to keep the land usable by vehicles and trucks and even by some of the agricultural activities that are happening out on the west side. Another reason that we would want to avoid increasing the drainage is when toxic substances, including nitrate fertilizers, could be drained into the water table or surrounding environments. As we know, there's a lot of toxins that are used in commercial agriculture, and so it's something to consider that either current uses of toxins or perhaps previous uses of toxins could be leached into the groundwater when we increase our drainage.
Hmm. Oh, very interesting.
So another thing that we can do is we can add organic matter. And from my research, I read a few places that said that adding sand can actually worsen the problem. In clay soils, that if you add sand, it actually can create kind of like a concrete.
A concrete. Mm.
Yeah, because it's filling in that pore space, sand being a much larger particle than the super fine clay particles. And as we know, when we're creating a road surface, you use rock of different sizes so that it stays together. If you use all rock that's all the same diameter, it's always going to be moving around. But if you use rock of different sizes, it kind of locks together. So
okay,
we
so
don't
scratch
want to do that.
What I said this on sand.
However, if we add organic matter, it decreases compaction, and of course, it will also encourage the earthworms, which seem like a lowly creature, but they have a tremendous effect on the aeration and the drainage of the soil.
Very cool.
Yes. This is In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts Paul and Robin. And right now we're going to our segment on good growing of cacti. And our guest is Sherry Sorensen. Sherry operates Rainbow Acres Cactus and Succulent Nursery in Makawao on Maui, which was first established in the mid-1970s. Rainbow Acres has been lovingly cared for by Sherry for the past 15 years and has grown to now feature the largest selection of cactus and other succulents in the state of Hawaii.
Wow.
The nursery is located at 3,200 feet elevation on the slopes of Haleakala and is open to visitors each week. Sherry, thanks so much for calling in and joining us on the show today.
Hi, Paul. It's good to hear from you.
Well, we pulled up a map of your location on Google Maps, and boy, it looks like a tremendous, spectacular spot you have there.
It is. It's wonderful up here. We've got the views of two coastlines and a lot of sunshine in the summer and nice cold temperatures in the winter, which a lot of the cactus like. That's what makes them put their blooms out. So,
right. It sure gets cold in the desert where a lot of that cacti is from, yes?
Yes, that's true. That's what makes them set their blooms is the cold, the shock of the cold in the winter. So the colder it gets in the winter, generally speaking, the more blooms you have.
Mm-hmm. So tell us, how did you get involved in the cacti world?
Well, a friend of mine bought this property when it had been pretty much abandoned, the nursery itself, and there's a house here on the property, too, where the caretaker lives, which is me, and asked me if I'd take over, and I was happy to. I haven't really worked with cactus and succulents before, but I have worked in a couple of other nurseries, so it's been a huge 15-year learning experience for me.
And how is it different from... What is the paradigm shift in terms of caring for cacti as opposed to caring for other plants?
Well, cacti really like it best if you just ignore them. You can't love them too much. You can't water them every day. They like a little bit of time to themselves.
Very cool.
And do you keep a lot of your collection in pots so you can move them out of the rain, or how do you manage the unpredictability of the weather?
That is a challenge here in Hawaii. It's probably our biggest challenge is the rain, and this year in particular we've had so much of it. I don't have the capability of moving things inside just because of the size of our operation here.
Sure.
So we pretty much just have to deal with it. We lose a few cactus every year, but there's also the option if they rot out at the bottom from being too wet, you can cut them off at the line where they turn good. And let them dry really well, maybe a month in a shady area. And then they'll put them in the dirt, and they'll start right up again.
Incredible.
So do you grow both the tropical-type cactus and the desert-type cactus?
I do. We have epiphyllum, which are the epiphytes that grow more in, like, Central America, the ones they grow more in the rainforest. They like a little more shade. They'll normally grow in the branches of the trees and the crotches of the tree branch and just hook themselves on there. Those I do keep inside a covered nursery because
mm-hmm.
they prefer filtered light and a little more water than the rest of them.
A bit more humidity, I would think, too, than the desert guys.
Yeah, yes, they do. I don't really have an operation that has like a humidified room or anything. We pretty much, the great thing about cactus and succulents is they're so adaptable. Pretty much wherever you start them growing, even if the mother plant has a problem, it'll start sending off babies that are more adaptable to that climate or that area where you are.
Mm-hmm. And do people have luck in a similar way where people will tie orchids onto their trees? Do you have customers that have success with those tropical cacti and doing the same thing if they have the right kind of microclimate?
Similar. Most of them do need a little bit more nourishment than the orchids. So a lot of the orchids can just live pretty much on just hanging onto the tree. So there's got to be a little bit more sustenance than orchids take. But I see people around in the area that have them growing in the trees like that.
And so how does one apply a fertilizer to an epiphytic cactus? Do you use a foliar feed? Do they respond well to that? Or
Yes. With that type, I use one of the sprays, you know, that you dilute with water and spray on. And they do. You don't want to fertilize any of the succulents or cacti too much because they're just not used to that in their natural habitat. But once a year, I use a time-release fertilizer on granular time-release on the cactus big cactus. And on the epiphytes, I use a once-a-year foliar spray.
So I want to come back to the jungle cactuses, but I'm super curious which of the desert cactuses actually perform best for you in our climate here, if you could give us some variety names and ones that you offer.
That's kind of a hard question. I have a large variety of cactus in the Cirrus family, which is generally your taller stand-up cactus. There's many, many, I mean, 50 probably different varieties. And they, I would say probably the ones that grow taller have a tendency to do better in the damp climate just because they have less surface next to the dirt, next to the water, where the globular, the ones that get big, fat, and round, they've got their whole, a larger amount of cactus touching the wet earth.
Right, which right. The barrel.
To rot out.
The barrel types, is that
exactly.
What?
Exactly,
yeah.
Uh-huh. But we generally don't lose more than one or two a year. I have to admit, we do lose a couple to the rain probably every year. Part of it, again, is if you do have any kind of pest, any kind of weak spot, that's going to be your first area that rots
mm-hmm.
out,
mm-hmm.
You know, that is more susceptible to the moisture as well, if there's any openings in the skin of the cactus.
We are speaking with Sherry Sorensen. She's the manager of Rainbow Acres Cactus and Succulent Nursery in Makawao on the beautiful island of Maui. Gosh, I wish you were closer. We'd be heading over for a tour later today. But we get over there every now and again. Sure can't wait to see your place when we're coming by. I'm wondering if you work at all with grafting. I've seen some grafting of cactus done. And is that a technique that's important for you as a grower?
Not so much. That's a specialty area there. I do have a few grafts that I've done myself just for the interest in them, the uniqueness of the grafts. They have a tendency, from what I can tell here, the moisture does kind of affect the grafts. I don't know if it's the moisture in the air, but I have had kind of a hard time keeping them going. You know, they'll eventually moisten up where you've grafted them.
Sure.
But I do have one here I'm looking at that's been going for about 10 years now. It's pretty interesting. I grafted a barrel cactus onto a taller, tall-growing cactus. So we've got kind of a tall cactus with a big fat head on it.
Oh, cool.
So amazing that cacti, even of different genera, can be grafted together.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like something you never get away with.
There's a wide range that do have compatible centers. You know, as long as you get the center of the cactus together and get it mated well, they'll grow.
Wow, what an art form. Well, looking back into the jungle cactus, probably one of the most popular ones that a lot of people know about is the dragon fruit cactus. Is that something that you grow there?
We have been experimenting with the dragon fruit. It's, again, kind of a specialty growing pattern. When the farms that they have here, they grow them up on stalks or on poles, and they grow them up, growing up the pole and then branching out at the top. And that's how I've seen them growing in the farms here. We don't really have the setups to do that, but they grow better, I think, at low elevation. I think I'm a little high for them here.
Oh, sure.
To get their fruits. We do have a relative of the dragon fruit, one of its descendants, actually, that is the epiphyllum. And it makes little fruits as well. They're much smaller. They're like 2 to 3 inch size fruits. And with the flavor of a dragon fruit, but intensified, like 10 times.
Wow.
Nice. I bet that's tasty.
They bloom about this time of the year. They're all blooming right now, the epiphyllum. They're all beautiful, like 6 to 8 inch flowers and all different colors. And after the flowers go, then the little fruits come.
Well, blooming time is certainly a great time for folks to visit your place. And so why don't you tell us about your open days and what people can expect to experience there?
Great. Thank you, Paul. We are open to anybody, open to the public on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 9 to 4 and on Saturdays from 10 to 3 for the people who can't get up on work days. We get a lot of landscapers up. We do have a landscaper discount, and we've got a quantity discount. If somebody comes in and buys a lot of things, they get a discount for that. And I'd like to offer your listeners a little discount, if I may.
Please.
I can give them, if they can tell me that they heard our program here, I can give them a 10% discount. So we do ship to Kauai. You can check out our plants on our website, rainbowacresmaui.net. And get an idea. I've got just a fraction of what I actually have here in pictures on the website. We keep trying to add more pictures to it. But if someone has something that they're looking for in particular, if they've got a picture of it, they can send me a picture, email us a picture at our email address is rnbowac@maui.net. And that address is also on the website. If they rainbowacresmaui.net, it's kind of easier to remember.
Fantastic. And do you want to give people your phone number, too?
Sure, that would be great. You can call us. We won't necessarily answer on any days but Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. But you can also call and leave a message with any questions or anything you want to ask about. And that would be at 808-573-8318. And either myself, Sherry, or my assistant, Rose, is the most knowledgeable about things we have here at the nursery.
Fantastic, Sherry. Well, before we have to part ways, I'm wondering if we could discuss a little bit about some of the pest and disease problems that you can help us get past. I don't even know, without experience growing cactus myself, what happens other than mealybugs seem to happen with any plants when you neglect them too much, but what other kinds of pests do you have to treat?
Well, mealybugs are definitely a problem for us too. Even if you're checking your plants every other day, they can not be there one day, and you go look at it the next day, and they're all over it. But we try to stay away from the real chemical kind of things. Just everybody that works here is kind of really aware of that kind of stuff. So we do use the products that are marked as safer soap or safer, you know, there's various different brands of safer soap that doesn't use the chemicals. And that really seems to affect the mealies well. You just have to keep at it, do it once a week for 3 weeks.
Right.
And that pretty much takes care of them. And, yeah, you've got to be sure and not spray them in the sun. That's one thing that is important because the soap will concentrate the sunlight, you know, pretty much. So if you've got little droplets on it that has that soapy on it still.
And do you pop the cacti out of their pots to get that mealybug that's under the soil as well, or you don't find that there is much?
There are some, when we pop them out and re-root them, that we find there's the root mealies in the soil. There's another thing that works well. You want to be careful with this one and not douse them too much. The other thing that bothers cactus is scale. We get scale often here, a couple different kinds. There's the brown helmet scale, and there's just a little white round scale that is a dot that sticks to the cactus. And just rubbing alcohol. There's two grades of alcohol, and you don't want the really strong one, but it's like the lesser percentage of alcohol. Mm-hmm. And again, definitely not in the sun. They've got to be in a shady area. But that works on the root mealies. You can spray the dirt, and it'll soak into that and kill the root mealies, and it also kills the scale.
Nice. So well, that sounds pretty simple. And are you plagued by any disease problems in the cacti world, or are you free of those?
I'm just took me a minute to think about that. I really don't think we have our biggest problems are the pests. We haven't really run across much disease per se.
What a blessing.
Pardon me?
What a blessing. So many of the crops that we focus on have so many new emerging diseases that are of such concern and such economic impact to growers of various kinds of plants. So it's nice to know that the cacti are resilient in more ways than just their armored appearance.
Mm-hmm. They are pretty resilient to most things. As far as I can't really even think of any disease type things that we have in the succulent world here on the islands anyway. You know?
Well, Sherry, I read a really fabulous book last year called The Perfect Red, and it's about the cochineal scale. And I was wondering if you've ever spotted that. When I did some research, I found that it does exist here in the islands. And interestingly enough, that scale has a marketability all its own. I wonder if you've run into that in your system at all.
I have never seen one. I've read a lot about that and the different things that they've used it for, you know, in the past in our history and things like that. And I've never run across any of that here. Ours is all just the really basic, either, like I said, either the white or the brown helmet scale is pretty much the only things we've seen.
Right, right. Well, in the 15th century, it was really popular for dyeing clothes. It was a red dye that actually was color fast. But more recently, because of the health fears of artificial food additives and toxic dyes, it's now used in lipstick and food coloring and all kinds of stuff, handmade textiles. At the moment, it looks like Peru is the largest exporter of the cochineal. But it's just such a cool, to me, I kind of really love that the pest itself has its own marketability. I don't know, there's something really cool about that to me.
I agree. I've read with interest different things about that.
Well, Sherry, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll let folks know at the end of the program all about how to get in touch with you, but Rainbow Acre sounds like an enchanted refuge up on the high slopes of Haleakala, and the next time we're over on Maui, you can bet that we'll be knocking on your door.
Well, I'll look forward to seeing you. We do have trails, walking trails through the gardens, too, that have plants that have been planted in the ground since the 70s, so
wow.
There's some really large varieties of things as well.
Lovely.
Far out.
Well, thanks a lot, and if you're ever over on Kauai, please give us a call, and we'll be happy to tour you our gardens as well.
Oh, thank you, Paul, and thank you. Nice to talk to you, both of you.
All right.
Aloha.
Aloha.
Yeah, so interesting. About the cactus, some of them, I noticed, have a pretty high rating on the invasive, their invasive species, or... Paul, remind me.
The weed risk assessment.
The weed risk assessment.
Yes.
And it was interesting to me because some of the ones I'm growing in my own yard rated with a pretty high score on that.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me a little nervous about, you know, should I be growing these? What do you think about that?
My opinion is that you really have to weigh all the different factors when it comes to the potential invasiveness of a plant or the propensity for a plant to naturalize and establish in the environment. And one of the big factors is taking into the economic importance and really the severity of the environmental impact that could be involved. So I know that one of the larger ones was one of the dragon fruits, but of course that's such an important economic food sustainability plant, and no indications that I know of that it is threatening native habitats. There may be information about that out there, in which case we would have to look into those factors. But you kind of have to weigh it all out. And I think cacti, an interesting one where I would say under almost all circumstances, any plants with thorns is kind of a no-go for me. But when it comes to the cacti, they have to have thorns. I mean, it's one of their identifying characteristics. They must have thorns. And so it's just a matter of keeping, you know, choosing wisely and staying vigilant and making sure that any potential outbreaks are managed. And certainly when outbreaks are in the early stages and plants are in vegetative growth, then, actions can be taken, but of course seeds can be spread far and wide by birds.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's up to each one of us to get informed and to avail ourselves of the existing literature and research and to make a wise decision as together as a community. We do have landscape industry councils here that are working on developing best management practices, and it's just something we really need to be informed more and more about.
Well, the one I speak of mostly when I ask you that question is the opuntia.
Yes.
And the opuntia is also known as the prickly pear or nopales. And it actually, it's native in South America, Central America, and Southern North America. But it was introduced into Australia to provide sort of a living fence for various reasons. And it actually went nutso, and it became a serious problem in Australia. And it's interesting, one of the other pests that's associated with cactus is called Cactoblastis cactorum, and it's actually a cactus moth. It doesn't proliferate in the cactus's natural habitat because things like ants or monkeys do a pretty good job at controlling this particular moth, because apparently it's pretty tasty to them. But they actually then in Australia introduced this moth to help control the outbreak of cactus. So when we talk about the weed risk assessment, I mean, the plant itself could be the pest, and then there's pests that can control it. And I just thought it was very interesting that it can be employed, that a pest can be employed to take care of an invasive species problem.
Right.
I just thought that was really interesting.
Absolutely. And we live in a very dynamic biosphere, and we are making a lot of choices that have far-ranging effects. So very important for us to all be having this discussion as a community. And thanks again to the Kauai Invasive Species Committee and other organizations that are helping to keep us, the Kauai Resource Conservation Program and other organizations that are helping to keep us on the leading edge of control of potential invasives in our ecosystem. So that's pretty much what we have for the show today. We do have one announcement for you. Voyage of Discovery Art Exhibition at NTBG is reaching its final week, so you just have a couple more days to go see that, the rare botanical prints from Captain Cook's first Pacific expedition down in Kalaheo. It's through May 30th, so I guess finishes on Friday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. For more information, call 332-7324, extension 227. If you'd like to have your ag-related event or announcement shared on air, please email it a couple of weeks in advance to inthegardenonthefarm@gmail.com. We'd like to thank our guest on the show today, Sherry Sorensen of Rainbow Acres Cactus and Succulent Nursery in Makawao. And you can be in touch with her by calling her up at 808-573-8318 or email rnbowac@maui.net. And she's offering a special 10% off for the listeners of this show, and she'll send cacti all around the Hawaiian Islands. They're also going to be at the Lawn and Garden Fair at the Maui Mall from 10 to 3 on June 14th, and they'll have a huge assortment of their beautiful cacti there and other succulents that they grow, and they've been taking prizes home for their displays for years in a row, and so go and support cacti and all of the succulent beauties that deserve more attention in our gardens. This has been In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts, Paul and Robin. We'd like to thank the other members of the In the Garden on the Farm team, engineer Jack, phone tech Mac, webmaster Laura Christine, and our station manager Dean. Mahalo for making the show possible. Please tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life. Aloha.
Aloha.